Welcome to episode 35 of the Serious About Security podcast for April 15th, 2013, also known as Tax Day in the United States. This episode is, as usual, brought to you by the Center for Education and Research in Information Assurance and Security, or SERIAS, at Purdue University. Today I'm joined by Mike Hill, Keith Watson, and Josh Gillum via chat. I'm Preston Wiley. And today we'll start with Mike, who has the first article.
Thank you, Preston. The first article today discusses the Apple iMessage. An article came out in the last couple weeks that described how the feds, the DEA, could not intercept messages sent via iMessage between two iOS devices. They claim that the due to the encryption, the communications could not be intercepted regardless of who the cell phone service provider was. So whether you had AT&T, Verizon, or there's some other ones out there now like T-Mobile, they could not intercept these messages. However, some follow-up articles came about shortly thereafter that were critical of this claim. They say that this can easily be defeated if you've ever upgraded your iPhone, in that when you get a new iPhone and you're transferring data over, all of your messages show up magically. So therefore, Apple must be storing these messages, and Apple has to hold the key to those messages. So therefore, if the government approached them and asked for that data, they would need to turn it over. So there's been some speculation as far as why this information would be released. And in fact, it was, you know, the DEA didn't just come out and say this. It was from a leaked document that revealed that it was difficult to intercept these messages. I guess you'd say some conspiracy theorists or whatnot are saying that this is probably not an accidental leak of a document, that there was probably some reason for them to make this claim, and that you know, in some cases they may be trying to lure iPhone user, you know, criminals who use iPhones into maybe using them more carelessly, you know, saying, oh, well, I'll send you this really sensitive top secret information through iMessage because the feds, they can't intercept this and can't understand what we're saying to each other, and it can't be used against us. So I thought this would be an interesting thing to discuss. You know, I will point out that it was noted that Apple's privacy policy authorizes the company to divulge customers' information about customers to law enforcement when reasonably necessary or appropriate, or to comply with the legal process. So my take on that is if they're presented with a warrant, they're going to be able to see what messages have been sent out via my iPhone, regardless of whether I was using iMessages with encryption or just standard SMS messages. So what do you guys think?
I think that this is one of those cases where it could go two ways. One is that the government is really clueless, which frequently they are, or this could be a bit of, as you said, disinformation to try to encourage people to use a technology that they know to be easily broken, either through technology means or through the ability to just knock on Apple's door and say, hey, excuse me, Mr. Apple, can you provide me with the content of this user's iMessages? So it could go either way here. It's not clear. I mean, if it is a disinformation campaign, with a leaked document, could be pretty impressive if that's the case.
Well, I think it may also be a combination of the two. I think traditionally with SMS messages, they can place an intercept within the cellular network or whatever and capture these messages real time. While with iMessage, instead of going through the carrier like SMS messages do, they go through Apple. And so unlike the traditional SMS messages that I'm sure they're used to capturing, this would be a different process and a different procedure for getting these messages. And so it's, you know, and something that's different or new can be confusing to the feds or the police, because they don't know exactly how it works yet. And so this may just be them not quite knowing how to handle this at the moment.
And that could be true, because if you may recall a law known as CALEA, and that is the Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement Act, and this came out, was passed in 94, and required that telecommunication companies have a duty to cooperate in the interception of communications for law enforcement purposes, okay? And one of the requirements was that telecom providers made changes to their equipment so they could quickly tap any phone conversations carried out over its networks and making call record details available. Obviously, with iMessage, you're dealing with Apple, and since it's an end-to-end encryption system, yet they have some control over the messages because they store them, and you can also recover them, that they certainly have the ability to capture these messages, but they're not a telecommunication company. So the ease at which the government can get access to information from a telecommunication company does not apply, because I believe CALEA is specific to just telecommunication providers.
Right, and in some cases, when law enforcement wants to essentially look at people messaging, it's, you know, they need the immediate messages, and with Apple, they can get an archive of the messages, it sounds like, if they have a warrant or they have some, or Apple agrees that legal, that they should have access to them according to their terms of service, but they really don't have any way of getting essentially a log of the messages without a court order to do that.
Yeah, so it sounds like if it's something that's real time and sensitive to real time, you're probably better off with the iPhone messaging using iMessage. But if it's something that's being built up over time to use in you and to use against you in court, that iMessage may actually work against you, because something I read basically said, you know, Apple could turn over all those messages going back a very long time. It was a little, you know, Apple doesn't say a whole lot about iMessages, so it's a little unclear as far as how much they keep, but it's not unreasonable to think they might have a whole history of your iMessages. I mean, it's definitely plausible that they would have that going all the way back, whereas SMS messages seem to have a much shorter lifespan. But again, in real time, they'd get you kind of immediately because they could intercept those messages. But if they're building up a big legal case against you, they might be able to gather more information if you are using iMessage.
I think it's completely possible that Apple does store quite a bit, if not everything, because I seem to recall they have a huge data center in North Carolina, just the right sort of place where you might want to store a lot of information. Just a thought.
And I'm fairly certain that cell phone providers do not store every single SMS messages that goes across their system as well.
I think they store them for a particular period of time. I seem to recall reading something about messages being stored for a certain amount of time for each carrier. I'd have to look to see if I could find that again. But that was kind of interesting. Some of them stored it for 18 months, some of them stored it for 6 months, and then they purged it after a while.
Okay, well, I guess we'll see the future of this, if anything comes out of it, but I think we've probably heard the last of what we're going to hear about iMessage for a while, unless Apple makes a statement, which I don't think they will, or the government makes a statement, which I don't think they will.
Yeah, I believe the article said they both declined comments on the leaked document.
I think, it's typical of what we would see in, you know, just given different companies as well. They're less willing to talk about those sorts of issues. Unless there's a big public uproar about what they're doing with their data. But Apple fan base seems, and I would say customers, but it's really more fan base, they don't typically care as long as they get good stuff out of their phones. No offense, Mike.
None taken. It is a good phone, I will say. I put a little plug in.
Well, we can move on to the next series of articles, and this is related to Mozilla. Last week, they announced the second beta of Mozilla Persona, which is an identity system for the web. And as we have talked about many times in this podcast before, we have an issue with a lot of users. For every web service they want to use, they have a unique username and password that they have to use for each site. Every time they want to use something new, sometimes they got to create another account. And we've always recommended that people store that information in a, you know, a secure password managing system such as 1Password or LastPass or one of the others whose name escapes me at the moment. But Mozilla is trying to tackle this from a different way. And so their approach is to kind of make sure that each user has control over their information, but accessible through their web browser. And the kind of the opposite approach to this might be considered OpenID, which was a standards-based system where you would use an identity to access a variety of websites, and you had a unique identifier for your use. And so you would sign into your OpenID provider, and then that provider would provide the credentials you needed to sign into your websites. And I think the problem here is Mozilla is going to run into similar issues as OpenID did. Mozilla Persona attempts to solve a different problem that OpenID does not, and that is privacy. Because they're method uses information stored in your web browser to do the credential exchange, whereas OpenID, you had to rely on a third party, and you had to trust that third party. And that third party could also track what sites you logged into, because whatever site you wanted to talk to had to talk back to the third party identity provider. And this method claims to not have to do that. And so they've issued their second beta, and they're trying to encourage more websites to sign up and start using this. Currently, there aren't too many. One thing they did do is provide a bridging service. So you could take a webmail provider, somebody with a large number of accounts, and integrate the Mozilla Persona system into that so that those users could start using it right away. And so I thought this is interesting from the point of view that it tries to tackle the problem with having multiple web accounts, and this is just another solution to that. It remains to be seen how well this works, obviously. But they do have a beta out. They have all the source code available so people can review it. So I thought we'd talk a little bit about this today.
Well, I did test it out right before this podcast. And the one thing that kind of disappointed me is the lack of any sort of two-factor authentication in the system, which I think is something that's important and is kind of people are adding it on. I mean, Apple added a two-step authentication process even, and Google has it, and Facebook has something. And I think it's something that's noticeably lacking from this system. And in the second beta, you know, I don't think it'll be out before they get out of beta with it. And I'm kind of disappointed that it didn't start out with a two-factor authentication approach to it.
Yeah, that tends to drive it down a little bit, I think, Preston. I think those are interested in security will want that second factor authentication. I think it's a really great idea, however, and maybe they'll bring that along. The one piece I see here that's going to make it really difficult is how many sites actually will end up adopting Persona support. As Keith mentioned, not too many sites give you the ability to log in using it yet. And I think that's going to be the make or break for it. If sites don't incorporate it, you're not going to really be able to take advantage of it. So they're going to need those major sites that, you know, those really popular sites that people visit to support it. And, you know, I don't know, unless it really catches on, I can't see the big sites, you know, like Google and Facebook necessarily adding that support right up front, because they have their own authentications that they're encouraging people to use. So they probably won't be the early adopters of it. So I think that's going to be the challenging part for them.
And I think you hit on a key point there. If you look at the Facebook and Google approach to using their identities to log into other sites, part of that is they want to see where you go. Facebook would really love to see what sites you go on. If you use the Facebook comment system on another third-party site, they're going to want to see all that. With the Mozilla persona system, they lose out on seeing that information. So I really don't see Facebook adopting this at all. I really don't see Google adopting it, although they're more likely than Facebook perhaps to do that. But that's a big problem, because you have a lot of sites where, you know, log in with your Twitter ID, log in with your Facebook ID, log in with your Google ID. Those sites will then lose out on any information from getting, you know, grabbing data from the profile of the user or a list of their friends or that sort of thing. They'll lose out on that. And the provider, Facebook, Google, Twitter, whoever else, they're going to lose out on seeing where this person has been, what they like, you know, what their comments have been on these third-party sites too. And so there's less incentive for them to sign up, because that kind of breaks their business model. And we know how a lot of businesses don't like to change their business model. I don't think this is one where we're going to see them jump on board either. But, you know, if you go back and look at OpenID, they had similar problems, right? Even OpenID, which, you know, minus the trusted third-party approach, still had issues because of its adoption, and it's still not widely adopted anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, that'll be the key, is whether or not anyone will really take off in adopting it. And that's, you know, like I said, unless they can really get some major sites behind them. I'm assuming that just because of the integration they already have with the Yahoo, with the identity bridge, that Yahoo might be one of those sites, but it's not as big a player anymore as those other sites. So, I mean, I think they really need to get some wide adoption, and that's a, you know, that's a hard thing. I think that's a hard thing to do. And without that, I'm just afraid it's gonna fade away, because, you know, people that, I think the real value in it is, I can go to all my sites using this one persona, and if I can't, is it really worth then using it? I mean, if there's just one site that I want to go to that doesn't support it, is it worth having? You know, does it really save me much then if I still have to then manage all those other things separately?
Well, another question that I have is, say there is wide adoption, and, you know, you can sign on using this method from everywhere. We're talking about one password that gets you into every single site on the internet. And that seems to me, especially without two-factor support, seems to me to be kind of, I don't know, is that a good thing? I mean, it's easy for the user, but then again, you have one password. If somehow the system gets broken and or somebody has a keylogger on your system, they basically have all your accounts all just right there at their fingertips.
Well, that's a vulnerability, though. I mean, you could say that exists with LastPass. I know LastPass supports two-factor authentication, but it doesn't force it to be two-factor authentication. So, again, that's one where you store all your accounts, and if that password you use for LastPass gets broken, then you know, all those accounts that you have under it can all be logged into. So, I mean, that's a thing they're facing as well.
That's true. But I've used it. I signed up for an account, and currently on the beta, there is nothing that prevents me from using a really stupid, not strong password at all, which I did use a stupid, dumb, not strong password at all, just because I wanted to see if I could use it.
And your ID is what?
Yeah, my ID has access to nothing, so you know. But anyway.
But to contrast that the last pass, though, do they make you put a strong password? I don't remember now. Do
they have warn you? Yeah, they warn you about the strength of it.
Okay. They warn you a lot, and if you put in a not strong password, they will say, this is a bad idea, but you can still do it, but they warn you multiple times not to do it.
Okay.
Yeah, I think software vulnerabilities will still always be the Achilles heel here. And so Preston's point about having a two-factor identity may reduce some of that risk. Not completely eliminate it, certainly, because you know, once you're signed in, the software is still vulnerable to attack once those credentials are there, even with two-factor. So, you know, is it a perfect world? No, but then nothing is. So we're looking to ways to reduce risk for users, and this is another way of doing it. The question is whether, you know, technologically it could be sound technology, but if nobody uses it, then it's not very useful to users, as we've already mentioned. So that will be the challenge, I think, for Mozilla in terms of getting this adopted.
Well, and with me using LastPass, a method to store all my passwords in one spot, basically, and I had, you know, there's plugins for my browsers and things like that. There's nothing to gain from me using a single sign-on system versus just having different passwords to different accounts on different sites. It gains me nothing because it doesn't, from my perspective, it's just as easy to use LastPass as it would be to use a single sign-on system. And then I have a different password on every single site. So if one site gets broken into, then it's that site that's compromised and nothing else. The only thing I would gain is if it supported two-factor authentication. I could use two-factor authentication on sites that I normally couldn't.
Yeah, but you're talking like a security professional, Preston.
Yeah, you're not the audience for this.
Yeah, you use LastPass, and you know to generate different passwords. You can have a LastPass user that uses a total of three different passwords that are all weak for all their accounts, and they can keep them in LastPass with a strong password, which may not be offering that much more security. So I think that's a very valid point. Security professionals probably won't adopt it, I'm thinking, or at least a large amount of them won't. They'll probably play around with the technology, but I think this is trying to get at the average user who doesn't want the headaches, doesn't want to understand encryption and strong passwords. They just want a simple way to provide security, and that's why I think the number of sites that incorporate it's going to be the deal breaker for them. If they can't get a large number of sites to support it, then no one has an incentive to use it.
Absolutely.
Well, I think from a user, I'm gonna keep going on this topic. From a user standpoint, should we be encouraging users to use a single sign-on system with a strong password, or should we be encouraging them to use a password management system and use multiple strong passwords on multiple sites?
Well, I think if you were a security leader in some organization, you'd have to address all the issues associated with either solution, figure out what the risk is, figure out the best way to approach it, and determine which is the right approach for that organization. You know, if cost were a factor, then having LastPass may not be the right approach, but having the persona system might. But if they don't have access to a lot of the sites that, you know, because Persona is not widely adopted, then that approach isn't going to work, and LastPass might make more sense. So there's trade-offs to be made based on what the user population is and what risk we're dealing with.
Because this system does also benefit these websites who are using it as well, because they can kind of say, we're using this authentication system instead of storing our own passwords. We don't have to store any passwords. We can use this instead.
Absolutely.
So it benefits more than just the user. It benefits the user and the site using it.
Right. And you could probably develop a lot of internal apps in an organization that used the Persona system and save a little cost there in development and security for those. So there's trade-offs to be made, you know, whatever system is used. But I think adoption is going to be the big issue.
Right, and I agree. And OpenID you know, how well adopted has that been, and things like that. It's going to be tough. I mean, and the big sites, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, they're going to not use it unless its popularity balloons to unprecedented levels.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's the key. But, you know, at least Mozilla is big enough to maybe make some waves there and to get in with some of those larger organizations. But, you know, it'll just take time to see how quickly it gets adopted. And like you said, without that second factor, you're not going to have security professionals maybe encouraging it as much as they would. But you know, I think it's still it could be a really good solution, but without two factor, I think, like you said, Preston, you're not going to go away from LastPass because it doesn't do the two factor. Now, if it did, I'm assuming you'd probably be a little more interested in looking at it and seeing what you could do with it if it supported two factor.
Well, yeah, if it would let me log into sites that I normally can't log into with two factor using two factor, then that might, you know, get me on board with it.
Well, we'll have to see if they add that in a later release.
Yeah, we'll see. And with that, we'll...
Well, before we go, real quick, Josh asked a question in the chat related to our first article. I thought we'd revisit that real quick before we end.
Okay.
And that was, for people that are concerned about others seeing their messages, will the DEA leak increase Android sales so users can use Orbot, which is basically Tor on Android, to protect their communications? My personal opinion is that people buy Apple products because it's an Apple product. I don't think the privacy of the device is of any concern to people who are Apple users. That's my personal opinion.
Ouch. well,
and that's good branding. That's good marketing.
There is good branding, and there is the whole. I know there's the whole Apple effect. As you're using your MacBook there, Keith, I will say. But I think there's some truth to that, but I don't think that's necessarily entirely true. I actually like the iOS setup. I like the fact that it's closed source. I like that how they do app approval. It doesn't mean no malicious apps get into the App Store. When you look at Android, it's just a free form field. I mean, there's so many. You can have two Android phones that are so different versions apart, and even if they're the same version, it's dependent upon their carrier. There's no real consistency, so there's all these little gaps. There's all these little opportunities. So I would say that privacy is important to iPhone users. But that being said, they do have a very loyal fan base, and they'd have to do something really, really bad, I think, to get people to move away from it. Because kind of once you kind of get sucked into that, you know, and you're using those devices, you're taking advantage of them, you really feel like you want to stay connected with that unless something really bad happened. But I do think they do some things very well. I think they've earned that reputation to a certain degree.
Wow, boy.
Well, if I were to guess, the people who would move over because of this have already moved over.
That's probably true.
And I don't know if there's a version of Tor for iPhone. I have absolutely.
I don't think
no
the
idea.
iOS system.
I doubt it.
Allow it to work.
I doubt it, but you can use VPNs on an iPhone and things like that, but that still doesn't solve iMessage. You just have to use some other messaging system other than iMessage, which probably is supported on the iPhone. I'm guessing there's other messaging systems.
Yeah, and you can. I mean, you know, there are folks out there that will jailbreak their iPhones, and they can then run all kinds of different things on them as well. But I think he's right. I don't think it's probably officially supported through the Apple Store. But I don't know. I haven't looked into it.
All right. Well, with that, can I end it now, Keith?
Yeah, you can. Please.
All
please,
right,
quickly that, before we devolve into a religious war.
All right. And with that, we'll end the podcast. Thanks to Mike Hill, Keith Watson, and Josh Gillum. I'm Preston Wiley. Have a safe and secure day.